Watch this. No way!
But this is, it's such a real treat because we've been in touch for a couple of years now, you know, maybe two or three years back, upon the release of your book about, you know,
sure,
just this infamous library you have and the history of Warton Heath. When did the passion all start for you with golf?
Well, amazingly young, thinking about it. And I think my first involvement with the history of golf, I was a junior member of Littlehampton Golf Club.
Really?
Because we holidayed down there and I was a member of both Bognor Regis and Littlehampton. And I was the one who used to go into the old pine panel dining room where there was the remnants of a club library. And I just used to go in and look at the books. I'm not suggesting I actually read them because firstly, there wouldn't have been that much time. But they appealed to me enormously. You know, the illustrations and how life was so much different and everything. And so that would have been my sort of teenage years. But then I became a country member and I used to go down there. And one springtime I went down there. So we're now talking about mid-60s. When I would have been about 24, 25. And they'd modernised the clubhouse. So the old pine panel dining room had become the mixed lounge. And I said to Jack Parvin, the steward, I said, where are all the books? And he said, oh, well, they've been chucked out. He said, in fact, they are actually down with the dustbins, but beside the dustbins, and they will be collected on Monday. So I went into the secretary's office and said, can I have the books, please? He said, yeah, take them away. So young Trode arrived the next day with two empty suitcases. No wonder I've had a back problem all my life. And I took away the club library.
Wow.
But of course, in those days, I was living at home and I had a small bookshelf in my bedroom and these books. And these would have been the books that a club would have had in the 1890s. Some bound volumes of Golf magazine, the one that became Golf Illustrated. And some of the handbooks, the golfing annuals and the Nisbet's Golf Yearbook. And those sort of books, sort of reference type books and books that would have been of interest to the members at the time. And okay, so that just proves that I was interested way, way back. But it wasn't until I had my own home, age 30, that I thought, well, I've got to start collecting these books. I mean, it was as much to do with decorating my new little Victorian cottage as anything. Because, you know, books do look, I think, look very nice on bookshelves.
They certainly do, yeah.
And it's sort of gone on from there.
Do you ever, is there a memory of a particular book that really ignited the passion? What was that book?
Yeah. So this was 1973 and first year of my marriage. Usually that's the sort of time when one gives things up, but that's when my golf book collecting really took off. My wife's always been very good about it. I've always said there's a different bank account that covers all the not the housekeeping's account. Anyway, so at Bognor Regis Bookshop, and as ever in those days, there were old books to be bought for not much more than 50p or 10 shillings as it was previously. And I got a number of books and I was happy to buy them for altogether for a few pounds. And I said to this guy, have you got anything else? What prompted me to say that? Because I really should have been perfectly happy with what I got. And he said, oh yes, I do have a nice couple out of the back. And he produced what is the Golf Book of East Lothian by the Reverend John Kerr. And this was the limited edition library copy, limited to 250 copies, signed by the author. And it's a great big fat tome with a leather binding. And I had never seen such a golf book. I mean, I had no idea such a beautiful thing even existed. And he wanted £35 for it.
Which felt like a lot at the time.
Well, it was a lot. Yeah. And then the other one was not quite so grand, but just as important. And again, both about 1897, Hughes's Chronicles of the Blackheath Golfers, which is always said to be the first club history, although actually it's not much in the way of original writing. It's more of a sort of anthology of stuff that had been written about the venerable Royal Blackheath, which doesn't go back to 1608.
Were the existence of those books at the time something that you were aware of because there was some sort of kind of, whether some sort of cottage industry around, you know, the sacred texts of golf, perhaps like there is now? Or were you almost uncovering what had value and what was of significance back then?
No, I had no sort of commercial interest in this. You know, it wasn't me sort of I do always remember as a youngster wanting to collect something. I had that you've either got this squirrel mentality or you haven't. Very difficult to acquire it. And I definitely got it, and I was immensely frustrated because stuff that was collected, you know, people had done it, you know. And I'm talking about silver, and I'm talking about pictures. But and what else did people collect? The whole collectible world, as we now know, just didn't exist in those days. So anyway, so going back to the Hughes book, he wanted 25 quid for this. So 35 and 25, that's £60, isn't it? 35, 45, 55, £60. I would guess that I got them for 50. I think the guy would have.
So he was at the eye for a bit of a bargain, even with good
books.
Well,
yeah, I mean, you have to. Yeah. You never want to try and pay the sort of full price anyway. That's sort of into my DNA. But the fact is, I hadn't got £50, but I did have something called an overdraft, and I thought, well, you know, the overdraft seems to be paying for pretty well everything. They might as well buy these two books. and that was a... And at that stage, I thought, well, I've got a... And thinking about it, I wasn't terribly stretched at Lloyd's of London, where I was working at the time. And I started to buy and sell golf books. And I had a little business called Golf Books. It's a registered business name. And I produced catalogues. And I was buying books from another dealer, and it was a deeply unsatisfactory experience because he was all he did was have a list, a line, author, title, date, price. No attempt to tell you what the book was about or indeed the condition of the book. And I just felt it could be done a hell of a lot better. So my catalogues were fully descriptive and so on and so forth. And I did that for about 8 years until I got a much busier job at Lloyd's, and it, from then onwards, it's only ever been a passionate hobby. Although it was only an extension of my collection that I did my dealing, and looking back on it, it was really quite entrepreneurial of me, and did a huge lot of good for my collection because I was seeing the quantity of stuff. And I never advertised to sell. I only advertised to buy. You know, there were people out there who wanted to buy these books. And then, of course, the prices went up and up and up and up and up. And I think by the end of the 80s, the prices had got to such a ridiculous level that it must have put people off. I mean, because by the end of the 80s, to set up a really nice golf library, you would have had to have an immense amount of money. But I've been consistent throughout this very interesting career in collecting golf books. I have never ever thought of the investment opportunities. I've always said, do it because you love it, and if you get lucky and it all works out to be more valuable than when you started, well, that's the bonus. The fact is, prices have... It would now actually be a very, very good time to be collecting golf books.
Is there a reason for that?
Well, because I think, yes, people aren't as interested. You know, the modern generation, they don't seem to be as interested
in
collecting golf books as a number of us were many years ago. And also the other thing is the books themselves have sort of found a home, and they're very little about. I mean, I haven't been into a bookshop to see if they've got a golf book for years almost.
What's your primary source of acquisition now?
Well, auctions.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, years and years ago, quite an established book dealer said to me, well, if ever we get an interesting looking golf book, we will put them into auction because it's very difficult to know what the market is.
Mm. Yeah. But we're sat here in your, I'm assuming this is your library. You might even have an even bigger library, but is this your wonderful library? Is this all the books, or have you got some?
No, all the club histories are down a long corridor. Okay, outside. Wow.
Do you have any idea how many you own?
Oh yeah, well I'm always asked this, and it's quite difficult. To the extent that when I was doing my catalogue in before I had this computer program and before David Normoyle helped me, I'd always had a different numbering system for the club histories, basically starting from number one and going through. And I've only ever collected UK club histories.
Okay.
I mean, I've been given quite a number of overseas club histories, but that's by way of a bonus. But one has to draw the line, and UK club histories. And I think before we moved here 15 years ago, I was you could never be complete, but I was pretty close to being complete. And subsequent to then, I've just been selective about buying club histories, clubs that interest me, and so on and so forth. And I think I've got about 1,300 UK club histories. Wow. But then the rest of the collection, okay, I now have a numbering system, but I have weeded out quite a lot of stuff, and I haven't really kept an eye on... So my numbering system goes up to about 5,500, I think, 5,008, 5,009. But... there are a lot of gaps in amongst that. I don't know. In answer to your question, my guess, educated guess, 4,000.
So how do you structure them? Because
I have been very selective. I mean, people joke. In one moment, I'm saying I've got 4,000 golf books, but I've been very selective. Yeah. People think, well, I'm pulling their leg. But I have been, because going right back to those early days, so we're talking about 50 years ago, I had decided to collect everything pre-1920. Because it was the old stuff that interested me. Pre-1920 really means pre-First World War. And then post-1920, I would buy those books that interested me and would actually have a good chance of being read.
Sorry, is that because of the aesthetic of the book, or because of the way they were written, or just the fact they were, over...
Old. I think I just love the idea of going back to a previous period, and it to me, the further back you go, the more interesting it is.
It's really interesting, because when we just before we started recording, as is always the way with these podcasts, you get into the real great stuff before you've hit the record button. But I think you said that you find the history interesting because it's the unobtainable, essentially.
Yeah.
And the fact that we look at the golden age greats and the ancient times of golf, talked about, I think you said Colt, very few people at his funeral, no obituary written about him.
Yeah.
But then as we get to sort of these times now, and you start to look, that's the fascination, is because it's so far back, right? And it's almost unobtainable, perhaps. Is that fair?
Yes, I mean, if there were only a very few people at Colt's funeral, I reckon at Fowler's funeral, okay, it was in the middle of the war. Apart from a few members of Walton, he's buried in the churchyard at Kingswood. There would have been hardly anybody there.
It's kind of like when, you know, people who live in London never go see the sights because it's so, it's like, you know, I live in London, I don't need to go see the London Bridge or I don't need to go to the Tower of London because yeah, it's yeah. so attainable. Yeah. And then only the people that, that come in infrequently
yeah.
want to see it, I suppose. Yeah.
I mean, we're almost certainly going to jump around this podcast a little bit across different topics, but I suppose the things that I'm, you know, really looking forward to talking about would be, you know, your areas of specialty being things like Walton Heath, Braid, Fowler, but also things like the book collection. There's so much to cover that you feel it's almost overfacing.
It's intimidating.
You know, and it's, I suppose, flipping that round a little bit would be almost do my job for me and tell me how should we spend the time
just
we've got to talk about.
Turn because him on and
I want to go all the way back to the ancient stuff and the antiquity books and stuff and club histories and Fowler. I mean, where do we all start? I suppose your life in the game beyond just the books I'm quite interested in and what leads us to Walton on the Hill where we're sat today.
I can't believe you're interested in a chap who is such a bad golfer.
Is that right? Has the books always been a way of escaping?
I got to 8 handicap, and I suppose 8 handicap at Walton is not too bad. All my friends were much lower, and I've always joke, although I'm not sure if it is such a joke, that my seniors, because I don't know how you view your lives, but there were quite a number of people who dictated my life looking back on it. I mean, the chap who decided I should be a member of Walton Heath, Alec Renshaw, we met them on holiday, and he clearly, I was going to say took a bit of a fancy to me, but that might be slightly out of order, but he thought
you were a good fit.
Yes, yeah. He saw that I lost my dad when I was only 2, so he could see that I didn't have any paternal advice assistance. So he was the one who decided I should become a member of Walton Heath, and it's sort of gone on from there. And somebody else decided I should be a member of Rye. I was captain of the Southeastern Juniors and the captain of the day in 1967, I think it was, Ken Wright. He said to me, now I think you should be a member of Rye, and it would have been very difficult to have turned him down.
Yeah.
So going on from there, and I've slightly lost the...
No, but
what I was going to say is that I think it was the old Cranleans who saw that I would never be much good at the game, but I would perhaps be very good on the admin side. So I was on the committee of the old Cranleans. That was the first ever committee I joined, and I was 20, so that would have been 62. And I'd become the on secretary of the old Cranleian Golf Society by the time I was 25. Now, I mean, can you imagine getting a 25-year-old to
you
become...
You wouldn't think of it now,
I mean,
would you?
Couldn't possibly... I mean,
it'd be a bit bizarre.
And I suppose it does also go back to the fact that, you know, I wasn't terribly stretched at work. I mean, that happened in spades subsequently, but at that early stage. And so I joined this place as a 21-year-old, Walton, 21-year-old, and just over 10 years later, I was on the committee as a young fellow, and then the Southeastern Juniors, and I was captain of that and ran that. And my last year, they chucked you out. In those days, they chucked you out over 25. Now it's 27. And then I ran Lloyd's Golf Club for 11 years and took them through the centenary. So I've seemed to have got involved in running all this stuff. So that's been a really interesting experience.
What makes for a good committee member? You've sat on many committees.
Somebody
I'm
actually
very curious.
There are plenty of people who will do a lot of talking. But there are fewer and fewer people who you know will actually get on and do stuff. You know, it's minuted that so-and-so is designated to do something, and I think fewer and fewer people actually will deliver.
I think it was McKenzie that said, I'm going to get this wrong, someone said to us recently on a pod, committees should be an odd number and less than three, ideally. But you know, I suppose committees in golf are always a source of frustration, and it's always it's a strange beast, isn't it? And I suppose when you join so many of them, you see so many people on committees, and the whole nature of golf club committees is quite fascinating. Yeah. So you almost got this golf career that's, you know, I suppose like anyone else, you're playing golf with people you're enjoying the company with, and then spending time at these different places, whether it's the Cranleans and being exposed to all of that, and your Blazer, you see a few of those dotted around, and you've got Rye and Walton Heath. So is that then sort of then what's igniting the thirst for more knowledge on people like Colt or Fowler or Braid?
Yeah, well then of course the I'd been a member of the Golf Collector Society in America since that was founded in 1970. So that's the really, really start of, you know, the golf collecting. I mean, there had been golf collectors. I mean, there was Harry B. Colt back at the turn of the last century who collected golf memorabilia. But, you know, he was very much a lone chap doing that. But so 1970 they started in America, and then in 1987 we started the British Golf Collectors Society, five of us, and we've now.
Sorry, did you start that? You set that up.
Yeah. Well, there were five of us.
Yeah.
There were five of us, and that's been a huge success, and we've got about 800 members. And the one of the unintended consequences of that has been the playing of Hickory golf, because this was not uniquely so. To form a golf society that had no plans to play golf seems a bit extraordinary. But if you look at the aims and objects of the society to this day, it only refers to the preservation and the interest in golf history and golf heritage and the collecting of the memorabilia and all of that. It doesn't mention playing any golf.
Right.
But the fact is, the Hickory collectors thought that they should start playing with some of these old clubs, and it's gone on from there. And there's a huge, I mean, somebody should really write the history, the modern history of Hickory play.
Mm-hmm.
Because if ever there was a sort of growth area of the game, okay, the numbers might be tiny weeny, but most people now have heard about Hickory golf. 30 years ago, if you started to talk Hickory golf, they wouldn't have any idea what you were talking about. But people do love it.
You play exclusively Hickory's.
Yeah. Yeah.
And prior to the society you set up, were you just Hickory then as well?
No.
So it's been you've switched back to Hickory golf, so to speak.
Yeah.
And do you find the game for you? You see it through a different lens playing Hickory golf as opposed to modern equipment. Obviously, you don't play modern equipment. But.
No, I think guys who, and girls indeed, who play Hickory golf, they've definitely got the very, very much the right sort of attitude. You know, I think they're happy people. They're people who are happy to be out of their comfort zone, and so often they're absolutely amazed how good it is to hit. Actually, there's nothing better than a well-hit Hickory, and after all. For generations, the hitting of a ball with a wooden shafted club was the thing that encouraged people to carry on playing. If you think about it, you know, if it was an awful experience and it just hurt your hands to hit the ball, they would have gone off and found something else. But as it was, for years and years, right up until 1920, you know, that's what hitting a ball was all about.
Mm-hmm.
So the well-hit Hickory happens to me sort of once every other year, but every so often when I do catch one, it does actually encourage me to keep persevering.
A good friend of ours is a Hickory enthusiast, and
who are you talking about?
Sam Cooper.
He's in
the Collector Society, and before I tried Hickory golf, you know, people would say to me that it's very difficult to understand the intentions of a golf course architect, certainly a golden age golf course architect, if you don't play Hickory golf, because there's things around that when you play modern equipment, you just don't notice. And then all of a sudden when the ball doesn't stop and, you know, it flies, but then it will roll a long way. A lot of different questions get asked on a golf course, don't they?
Yes. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I suppose when answering the question of, well, sort of why do you do it, quite difficult, I can only explain that to people, and they seem to be able to understand this, that, you know, you might have a very nice modern car to get you around, but actually it's quite fun to get out your vintage Bugatti or whatever to go for a spin. You know, it's just, it's like, it's got to be similar to that.
Yeah.
Getting the feel of what it used to be like.
Mm.
And I mean, in Sweden, there are a lot of young, much younger guys playing Hickory Gold.
Really? Is that right?
Oh, quite extraordinary. So they are utterly charming. They are such nice. They come over here and play in all our tournaments and usually take the silverware home. Mm. But we don't begrudge them it, largely because they do conduct themselves so very well indeed. And they, so in answer to my questions years ago, why do you play Hickory Gold? Purity of the strike. That's the one fundamental difference. And I mean, to the extent they've put Hickories on the driving machine up at St. Andrews, and they're about 8% off the pace.
Mm.
So a 300-yard shot hit with a modern club will go about 275 with Hickories. Mm. And people are amazed at that.
Yeah.
If you think of the advertising, and I think it's almost been hushed up, because if you think of the advertising, most years you would think that they've got an extra 8%.
Yeah.
But actually, over a period of, well over 100 years, it is actually only 8%. I mean, the ball is fundamental. But the most important thing and the biggest difference is that the Hickory has a blind spot that is... not a blind spot, a sweet spot that is tiny weeny.
Mm.
And of course the machine hits it perfectly out of the middle. Whereas of course, as you know, these big headed drivers, it doesn't matter terribly where you hit it. Mm. And that's why really good golfers, a scratch golfer who is by and large hitting the ball out of the middle of the club, will be amazed how well he plays with Hickories.
Yeah. Mm.
We've quite enjoyed recently playing. We had a retro equipment day at Minchin Hampton. Like a sort of get together, and we've got another one at West Byfleet coming up where people can come and play with Hickories, or they can come and play with Persimmon and Vintage Blades. And it's just very rewarding, isn't it? So,
yeah. Were you on the Common at Minchin Hampton?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great place.
Yeah, it's good fun, isn't it?
The one time I remember playing there, it was the day before the seniors match against the club, so it was a real treat to get out there. But of course, they're not allowed to mow it between sort of April and is it the end of May or middle of June?
Sheep take care of it all.
And it wasn't a matter of sort of where's the green. I mean, it was a matter of where's the golf course, you know. And it was just a field of buttercups. I mean, it was lovely. And I do remember playing with an absolute legend whose name was Dick Champion.
Okay.
No, and he had the course record at Westwood Ho for years and years and years, and was the deputy headmaster of Millfield, and I know his son Richard. And he'd gone up into his attic and found a rusty old iron, and you know, straight face, small headed iron, and he just played most wonderfully well with this thing, just gently, and was playing all sorts of shots. And yeah, and you have to, you know, carrying a few number of clubs, you have to invent shots.
Mm.
You have to hit them a bit harder or a bit softer, or you can cut them up. And good golfers say, oh yeah, well I can work the ball. You know, there's much more variety of shots that you can hit with these Hickories.
Yeah. Yeah, there's less of a blunt instrument, isn't it? You mentioned Westwood Ho there, which I thought would be a really good segue into, you know, another topic we'd like to talk about, which is, of course, William Herbert Fowler.
Yeah.
Who came to the game quite late. I must admit, this is full plagiarism. I devoured Matter of Course, your book with Derek Markham. Which came out a couple of years ago, which is a fascinating book about him as a character, someone I'd wanted to learn a lot more about. But he came to the game quite late in life, as my understanding, when he was living in Taunton, and started his golf at Westwood Ho, and we are sat probably 50 yards from the first tee at the old course at Walton Heath, which was his first foray into golf course design. Yeah. Maybe tell us a little bit about that chapter of his life.
Yes, I mean, there's a record, isn't there, that he did play down there as quite a young chap. But then he gave it up because he was a very good cricketer, you know, county cricketer. So that must have been important originally for Essex. And then when he moved down to Taunton for Somerset, and he did a lot to establish Somerset cricket as a proper, fully sort of paid up member of the county cricket community. And I think was president of Somerset cricket. And yeah, he was leading this wonderful life. To be given a bank as your first job is sort of indicative of what an incredibly prestigious, wealthy family he came from.
He was born into the pound seats, wasn't he, really?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
he was.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he was the local grandee, which must have been very good for his banking. And he had a big house on the, as a bachelor, the outskirts of town. Had a prize-winning herd of cattle, used to show flowers at Chelsea.
Yeah, big, like, yeah.
All sorts of things that a country gent entertained the local hunt. And then thanks to a senior member of the family, the whole pack of cards came tumbling down. And he, young, fouled through no fault of his own, was out of a job.
Mm.
And his wife was the sister of Cosmo Bonza, who had the land out here. And Cosmo Bonza really wasn't so interested in the Gulf, but he wanted to get people onto his railway line that he'd developed coming out to Tattenham Corner, Kingswood, where he lived, then Tadworth and Walton, and then on to Tattenham Corner.
Well, we went for a few meals at the Kingswood Arms in the week of the Open on our way back to our luxurious abode in Redhill. And the road there that takes you down is Bonza Drive.
Bonza Drive, yeah, that's it, that's it. So, and young, well, not so young, Herbert was playing cracking good golf, playing for England against Scotland, because that was the only international match in those days.
Big mixer in the R&A as well, wasn't
he? He joined the R&A.
He had a big sort of acceleration.
1894, and that magnificent picture, the medal day of 1894, the drive-in, which is depicts Balfour driving in, A.J. Balfour, due to become Prime Minister. And you've got all these characters, R&A members, and they're over on the left. And he'd only joined the club earlier that year. Mm-hmm. There he is, adjacent to H.S. Cole.
Right by him.
And I'm absolutely convinced they must have talked about their ideas. Because if you remember 1894... Colt was a young solicitor down, had captained the Cambridge team, and he was a young solicitor down in Hastings and had a lot to do with the laying out of Rye.
That's all he would have done by then, wouldn't he?
Well, that's
really
absolutely
very
right.
Early.
Yeah, a very distinguished. In fact, it was Donald Steele who corrected me because I said, well, I'm always careful because, you know, Colt goes back to 1892 and Fowler comes on the scene, you know, pretty much 10 years later. And so Donald said, no, you don't have to say that, Philip, because in fact, Colt might have done Rye in 92, but he didn't do anything else until, you know, quite a lot later. And Fowler, this was opened in 04, but we know that he was discussing it and planning it in 1899 through this family connection that he had.
Is that right?
His brother-in-law. It was his brother-in-law that had the land. And of course, because of his financial demise, Fowler was already owing money to his brother-in-law. Mm. So this was a way of sort of paying off some of the debt.
I suppose in those 1890s, when Colt and Fowler were in that picture together, though, these would have been the sort of big thinkers and within the game at the time, you know, high golfing IQ. They would have spent a lot of time debating and critiquing the merits of whether it would be Westward Ho or Royal Liverpool or the Old Course together, wouldn't they, really?
Yeah.
That's where this sort of school of, you know, the mega high golfing IQs, they would have sort of challenged each other, I like to think.
Yeah, and it was sort of real pioneer time.
Yeah.
And so he joined in 1894, and it was only a very few years later, let us say, 3 or 4 years later, that he had this filibuster at a general meeting of members.
Where, filibustering?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he got the meeting to agree, and it wasn't on the committee, it wasn't on the agenda, and he got the business meeting, as they're called, to agree that they should pay the secretary. So Mr. Grace, and you know, the Grace family had been secretaries of, honorary secretaries at local firm solicitors for even then way over 100 years. And yes, and it was Fowler who got it agreed as a new member of the club. So I think that just shows you that he was a very upfront, I would think reasonably arrogant sort of chap, but had a huge amount of self-confidence in himself that he could sort of take over a meeting. So then there was a tremendous schmozzle. You can imagine after the meeting, you know, totally unbeknown, they'd had this dramatic change in the way the club was going to be run. And it was the charming and very delightful Mr. Grace who, rather than sort of dig his toes in and make a lot of trouble, said, "Oh dear, well, you know, if you'd only told me, I would have been only too happy to agree to these arrangements." So he made it very easy for them to pay a secretary, not
but that
not
changed
to
the
pay
fortunes
him, but
of
pay,
the RNA almost. It would have given them an ability.
And 1897, they took over the running of the rules, and then, as I'm sure you know, it was only in the fullness of time when other clubs asked them to take over the Open Championship and the Amateur like Championship. And it was only my other great interest that we haven't mentioned is the Royal Isle of Wight Golf Club. Most people don't know about the Royal Isle of Wight Golf Club. It is only one of two royal clubs that has gone defunct. The other one is Royal Cornwall at Bodmin. Royal Isle of Wight.
Really?
Yeah. Royal Isle of Wight was at on the east coast of the Isle of Wight, it'll come to me in a second, started in 1882, which is really quite early. I mean, I explained to people, clubs starting in the late 80s are to a penny, but clubs starting in the early 80s, very, very few, very, very few clubs. So, and the name is Bembridge. It's just opposite the harbour at Bembridge on the east coast. And started by 1882 by one of those pioneers from Royal Liverpool, because there's no doubt about it, the members of Royal Liverpool really were the pioneers in England, you know.
Well, they were the gentlemen that kind of convinced the RNA to take on the mantle of
the amateur, wasn't it?
Yeah, like taking over being in charge of the game, I suppose.
Yeah. Well,
and John Ball Jr.'s win as well, of course, in 1890 set fire to it all, didn't it?
Yeah. But in 1882, it was founded by somebody called Captain Eaton, E-A-T-O-N, who was a Royal Liverpool member and a medal winner up there. And he'd been posted down there to run the Coast Guards. And he saw this lovely little piece of land, too small at 37 acres, but he could see you could build 9 holes there on the what was known as the Dover. But the thing that he did was he saw the importance of having a standard rule book, because you know, you adopted, if you just set up a golf club, you decided which club's rules to adopt. So very often people used to adopt the Royal and Ancients rule book, but if you haven't got a station master's garden or you haven't got a Swilken burn, it really doesn't make...
Is that what was in there?
Yeah, you know, the rules of the Royal and Ancient obviously catered for their particular golf course and you know the railway sidings and all of that. So he could see the importance. So he, in 1886, he published this rule book, and the introduction says, "This is our first attempt to have a standard rule book so everyone can use it." And on the strength of that, and in those days the only place where all of this stuff was published, letters to the editor and that sort of, was the Field magazine. And it was the Field magazine that actually in 1889, started Golf Magazine, which became Golf Illustrated. So the Field Magazine had a series of articles and, more importantly, exchanges of letters to the editor. And on the strength of this, it was being suggested by a lot of people that the having sort of set this ball rolling and the standard rule book, it should be the Royal Isle of Wight Golf Club that should become the governing body of golf.
Is that right?
Wow.
Yeah. So I always tell my friends at the RNA, think, you know, if it all worked out, we'd be on this down on the Isle of Wight on this little 9-hole golf course. anyway, so it had a very aristocratic, positively royal connection because of the close proximity to Osborne House, where Queen Victoria, and in fact one of her daughters, her favourite youngest daughter, who very much looked after her, was finally allowed to marry Prince Henry of Battenberg, and he became captain of the Royal Isle of Wight in 1894, and that is his portrait that used to hang in the clubhouse.
Right. So he became captain of
the Royal Isle of Wight.
Right.
But the fact is, it gradually died a natural death. And in 1962, it closed down and the land was given to the National Trust. And you can still see the golf course.
Is it used, just used as a parkland now?
Yeah,
it's
purely used by dog walkers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in a good state. And I would be very interested to know what terms and conditions attached to this gift to the National Trust, because I'm sure they're not actually maintaining it as well as they should do.
So, rewinding slightly, you've got Herbert Fowler's involvement here, and he lays out the old course.
Yeah.
1906, 1904.
Opened in 04, laid out from sort of 02.
Yeah. How was it received upon, because it's quite an interesting relationship it has, because it's on common land as opposed to some of the other golf courses in the area.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the beginning of this club, Walton Heath, in those early years.
Yeah, well, it took off. At amazing speed. And Bonza, the all-powerful Bonza, he was an MP and chairman of Watness Brewery and chairman of the London and Brighton railway line.
Bank of England as well.
Bank of England, on the board of the Bank of England. Yeah.
Massive. All sorts of things. Crazy.
Hugely. And he, if you look at the original committee, he definitely shipped in people who could be helpful. There was a guy called Malaby Deely, who was the great guy at Mitcham.
Mm.
And of course, it was Mitcham where the parliamentarians...
Princes Mitcham.
And of course, Princes down at Sandwich was a spin-off when, just in the same way as the members of Royal Wimbledon wanted to find somewhere quieter to play their golf and created George's, the members of Mitcham did the same thing.
Right,
that much later, not generally known about that. So he got a lot of people involved, but then so he did very well in getting it off the ground very quickly. But the guy who then really took it off the ground even quicker and grander was the George Riddell, who came along. And so often people feel it was George Riddell, they see his portrait in the dining room, that was the guy who started it. He took it over with two others, only 2 years after the club started. And he was a huge empire builder. And he had an interest in this small newspaper called the News of the World, brought in by the Carr family, I think, to revamp it and sort of get it cracking. And you know, anybody who could be of use to George Riddell was made a member here.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm not really quite sure how many of them actually paid a subscription, but
although he used it to further the interest of the club, I guess, really, and continue to, because it's fascinating that the club was proprietarily owned right up until, I'm going to say, like 71.
Yeah, 71. That's right. Owned by the News of the World. Because when Riddell died, he had a huge percentage of the News of the World shares, and it was the biggest circulation newspaper in the world, with 7 million copies every Sunday morning.
There's a member at Blackwell who wrote to me, because he knew we were at Walton Heath, and I'd put something up about the News of the World ownership, and that's why I wanted to get it up, because he sent me an email saying William Carr, who actually was a Blackwell member,
yeah,
which I didn't know, and he was part of that group that owned it. That's why I had the email from him.
So yes, so
that was why I was right. fascinated.
So when Riddell died, the club was taken over by the Carr family or the News of the World. It's always rather difficult, you know, in whose names the shares were, but it doesn't really matter whether it was the company or the individuals who owned the company. But yes, the Carr family took it over, and they were the ones who thought, well, we better have a club captain.
Yeah.
Because we've never had a club captain, because Riddell certainly didn't want anything as vulgar as a club captain. This was, you know, this was his club. He didn't agree with all this competitive golf. He had two meetings a year for a gold medal, and that was it.
Really?
That was it. So we don't have a whole lot of silverware that goes back to the formation of the club. You look at some of these. I was looking at one of the Sheffield clubs, and I suppose Sheffield, famous for its silver. I mean, they've got an amazing collection of silverware, because anybody who was anybody in the 1890s, turn of the century, were giving wonderful bits of silver to be played for. But we've never had that. We've subsequently acquired some nice silver from the time. And in fact, there was clearly a group of members in Riddell's time, who wanted to play competitive golf. Mm. So they had something called the Heathens Golf Society.
Hardly a great name.
Heath Ends of the Heath. Nothing to do with their religious connections. The fact that they were playing golf on a Sunday might have something to do with it. But I think the agreement was that you put up a box of balls once a year. So they played for the box of balls. And there were some trophies, because one of our trophies that we still play for has actually got Heathens Golf Society on it.
Really?
Is it really?
Yeah.
Right.
And what happened was that when Riddell died, and the new owners, the new proprietors, felt that, yes, competitive golf was a good thing and it's something the members wanted, they asked the Heathens Golf Society to become the competitions committee. So therefore... And then they bought some of their trophies. And so our keenly contested winter foursomes is called the Heathens.
Yeah.
And I want the midweek players, because we've now got a very strong midweek section with a lot of matches against clubs around and about. And we're known as the Walton Heath Midweekers, which to me lacks any sort of imagination. And I've said, we've got a name, you know, we should be the Walton Heathens.
Yeah.
But I keep plugging away, but there's some sort of hang up about that.
It's strange about the competitive play, because in the sort of a bit of research in advance of the Open, and, you know, reading your book and, you know, leafing through others, it, I get the sense... Well, firstly, I always think Walton Heath to be a tremendously competitive golfers club. I feel like members of Walton Heath are invariably very, very good ball hitters, and there's a lot of great golfers that have been through here throughout time. But also there's quite a strong history, I think, with championship golf in all forms. There was obviously the Hilton and Cecil Leach match, which perhaps you could tell us about. There's things like the News of the World, which was a very significant tournament, wasn't it, for many years?
Yeah.
So whilst there may not have been a lot of club competitive golf, I get the sense, was that George Riddell
put your finger on it. And, you know, leading up to this great tournament that we've just had, there will always be people who will complain about it, you know, because they're not going to be able to play their usual four ball that they play every other day throughout the year. So it upsets their routine. And, you know, I'm at pains to point out to this small number of people that we are where we are today thanks to our forefathers embracing competitive professional golf and amateur golf right from the word go, and particularly the professional golf. Okay, we all know now that if you can get a tournament, you know, and you want your course to be called a championship course, you just run a tournament and spend a lot of money and it gets you sort of on the map. But back in 03, 04, I mean, I don't think it was as obvious as that. And the fact is, they organised a competition. So it was opened in May of 2004, and there was a professional tournament within a couple of months.
Pretty remarkable.
And then the News of the World match play had been played at Sunningdale in 2004, and it came here in 2005. And, you know, we had that regularly. And although, quite understandably, you know, in the programme for the AIG, it would hardly be worth referring to something called the News of the World match play, because people just wouldn't, you know, the current generation of golfers just wouldn't know anything about it.
But essentially a major.
It was huge. Yeah. Mm. For years and years, it had a prize fund considerably bigger than the Open. Yeah. And I've actually done a bit of research, because, you know, you quote these things and then suddenly it's going into print and you've got to check it out. It wasn't until the late 50s that the prize fund for the Open exceeded the match.
Really?
Match play. And then the other thing, it's so often referred to as the News of the World match play, which is correct, but immediately after the war, it was embraced by the PGA. So it was the PGA match play, if you like, sponsored by the News of the World.
Would that be what Palmer won at George's? I dreamt that. Was there something?
No.
Palmer did win at George's in about...
Yeah, that wasn't there something called the All Cap?
That might have been the British PGA or something different. But but now what we have is essentially the BMW at Wentworth, which was the event that kind of just eclipsed it slightly. It came away from the match play, is that right?
Because I think during the 60s, because the News of the World PGA Match Play Championship used to go around the country to all the great courses and came back here every so often. But throughout the 60s, it was, I think, with the exception of one year, it was always played here, because I think the bottom line must have been that the News of the World were running out of money, and it was clearly a lot cheaper for them to be hosting it here rather than taking it somewhere else where they'd have to pay a big facility fee.
Yeah.
And that suited me. I joined here in 64 as an impressionable young chap, to have this major golf being played on one's golf course for the first 6 years of my membership was absolute magic.
So you would have been a member here then when Rupert Murdoch came to,
yeah,
essentially for a short period of time via the News of the World being the...
Yeah, I mean, I think he bought the company, I think it was in 1969, as the White Knight, because Maxwell was also after it, and he wasn't deemed to be quite such good news as Murdoch. And luckily, Murdoch wasn't interested in owning a golf course. Mm. Although I believe he was a golfer, but he certainly didn't want to own the golf course. So that did allow us to buy it, and that was completed in 1971. So we've been a members' club since 1971.
Fascinating stuff. Did that feel really momentous when you were a member?
Yes. I think looking back on it, because it is just such a good thing to own one's own golf club, and one can see the significance of that more, I think, now perhaps than one could at the time. But clearly, you know, the guys in charge, led by Alec Renshaw, who was the same chap who encouraged me to, or told me I should join here, they could obviously see the value of it becoming a members club, because there was a threat that it would be sold to some American company and they could fly people over here and that sort of thing.
Could we talk about Braid and his involvement a little bit? And
yeah.
Because he stayed on here as... What's quite interesting with Braid is tinkering's the wrong word, but he's like known as the great revisionist, I believe. He sort of, you know, spent a lot of time, you know, going to clubs, consulting, doing work with them. Never really touched the course here, from what I understand, but remained the club professional really from the day it opened to the day he hung up his boots. And
in 1950. So he was here from 2004, May of 2004, to November 50 when he died. Wow. And he was still in office when he died. And the significance of he was 80 in the March, and that was the first year he didn't break his age.
Really?
when he was 80. That was the first year.
And the press used to gather every year and take an interest.
I heard a rumor. Perhaps you can elaborate on this. And it feels like one of these rumors is going to be true now, just because it sounds good. Obviously, Walton Heath's a 36-hole complex. I heard a rumor Brady's made a two on every single hole on this complex. Yeah.
Well, that is stated in the Brady exhibition.
Wow,
and I did set that all up, and I had to keep the captions nice and short. And it's the one thing that was queried right from the word go. And I was really pleased because it did mean that people were actually reading it.
Yeah.
And I knew very well that I hadn't dreamt it up. I mean, you couldn't say it. And where it appears, it's in Bernard Darwin's biography of James Braid, which was published after Braid's death. And Darwin quotes it.
Wow.
So if you have any doubts, you've got to somehow contact
take it up with
a
good man himself.
That podcast with Darwin might be quite interesting.
I would really like a podcast with Darwin, actually. Yeah. I feel like this is about as close as we might get to it, actually. But
And I suppose he played a huge amount of golf, and whereas the pro today here or anywhere else is too busy running the business and doing all that, Braid was out there, I was going to say pretty much every day of his life, but that's obviously not correct, because he was doing a lot of travelling around, looking at all these and advising. So so there it is. And it's interesting also that he had 18 holes in one. That seems to be very symmetrical.
Right. All here?
No.
Oh, right.
No, I think...
But again, in 1964, as a young Truett, as you called yourself, the passing of James Braid would have been pretty recent. So you would have been hanging around with a lot of people at the club who would have known him personally and would have, you know, probably given you pretty good first-hand accounts,
yeah,
I might imagine.
Yeah, no, you raise an extremely good point. And I suppose it's that business of when something is sort of almost current, it doesn't seem so relevant. And anyway, young Truett wasn't so heavily into James Braid and history and everything. But yeah, there are a lot of people that when I see their dates of death, I think to myself, goodness me, what a shame it was that I didn't ever either get to know them or have the opportunity of speaking to them.
Who did we meet that had met him?
Pass.
But he was, there's no doubt, he was a very special chap, and his home that he moved into is just up the road from here, and that's where he went to live with his family when he arrived, and he stayed there for the rest of his life. And he was the sort of father confessor for anybody in the village. Anybody who'd got a problem in the village used to go and see Mr. Braid.
Really?
And... yeah, I think he was a very wise old bird. Didn't say a great deal, but what he did say, people hung on every word. And I think that goes from the people who were members here and, you know, influential people. I mean, there's a lovely letter that he wrote. It's in the clubhouse that that the Prince of Wales wrote to him when he did a very good score. And he concluded that he only wished that he'd been playing with Braid when...
So he was deeply respected at a time
deeply respected. Deeply
maybe, is it fair to say, there was a slight... You know, there was a sort of essentially a division between the professional and the amateur golfer where, you know, one was deemed to be sort of, you know, lower ranking or whatever. But he was obviously deeply respected here as a five-time Open champion and a loyal servant to the club, really.
Yeah. And actually... Can I go?
You can. That's exactly why we've mic'd you up on the lapel, because I'd like to.
No, because
we'd love to see some of that stuff.
A recent acquisition, but this sort of relationship between master and servant, if you like, and it was pretty prevalent. You know, up until not so many. I mean, certainly when I first started to play, you know, not necessarily this club, but clubs, the pro didn't come into the clubhouse.
Yeah.
And he was, perhaps the pro was allowed into the clubhouse, but only with a member. So there's that very, it's a sort of social division as well as a sort of golfing division. But I recently acquired this book, Advanced Golf by James Braid, which was a great success. It went to a number of editions. And I mean, this one, if you look, this is actually says first published in 1908. But it was republished more than once, just in that year. But I bought this because I couldn't believe, it says here, G. Riddell, that would be George Riddell, from his friend, James Braid.
Wow.
And I mean, I couldn't really believe that Braid was able to refer to his boss. And this is only after 4 years, because he came here in 04 and this was published in 08. But he felt sufficiently confident, Braid felt sufficiently to refer to Braid, to Riddell as his friend.
And been unthinkable, really.
Yeah. So, I mean, buying that made me have just that simple inscription has really made me have a total re-look at George Riddell, because I'd always had him down as a pretty severe taskmaster. And hugely ambitious, and didn't take too many prisoners.
I guess it was probably a lot more nuanced. That's the thing with the history that you're getting into, is you can probably fall into a trap of thinking, well, the professionals were second-class citizens, the amateurs were the ones that could go in the clubhouse, and that was the way it was everywhere. And the fact of the matter is, life's much more complicated and nuanced, and people would have been friends, and it would have been much more.
And even when Braid was made an honorary member, his son Harry, who played from out of the Artisans Club, he was made an honorary member of the club before his dad. And this is Harry Muirfield Braid. Muirfield, because he was born in 1901 at the time of his dad's first Open win.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
But I say to people, what a bit of luck. The championship that year wasn't played at Royal Lytham and St Anne's.
You touched a little on Darwin.
Darwin and Braid knew each other very well.
Did they?
And don't forget that Darwin only wrote the biography of one golfer. He wrote a biography of W.G. Grace, and he wrote a biography of a famous boxer whose name just escapes me at the moment, but it's up there somewhere. But he only wrote, writing something posthumously, in other words, after the person had actually died. Darwin must have felt that he had a sufficient knowledge about that person to write the biography.
Yeah, and it would be, obviously somebody that he had a huge amount of respect for to that length. Yeah. You mentioned Darwin. There's obviously a number of other people from around that era, whether it's people like John Lowe's, there's people like Hutchinson, there's Holderness, there's all these different characters all over the place. I'm curious, outside of, Fowler and Braid would be two characters very close to your heart, but who interests you more than anyone? Is there a figure that stands out in your head?
Well, certainly John Lowe.
Really?
Because I've got the John Lowe library here.
Okay.
And this was the famous library. I mean, I've come out of the closet over this one. Which I acquired from Woking.
Yes.
Who didn't know they'd got it.
Could you tell me about that? I think I might have heard this story. Yeah. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I was playing at Woking, and I think it was Lloyd's Golf Club against the Parliamentary Golfers, but that doesn't matter. And it's got to be at least 30 years ago, 35 years. And I was chatting to the steward afterwards. I don't know why that was, but we were chatting, and he told me, oh, yes, well, we've got a library here. And I sort of felt I knew Woking pretty well, but I couldn't remember a library. And I decided not to pursue it. He produced the original suggestion book, because he'd found that on top of the telephone kiosk in the hallway, and he sort of referred to it as his book,
And I thought, well, it's not his book. You know, it's no way it's his book. So anyway, I decided not to pursue it with the steward, but I'd obviously remembered it. And I phoned up the secretary, Tony Riley, who subsequently became a good friend and captain of the seniors years later, etc. And I phoned him up and said, you know, I'd love to come see your library. And he said, well, we don't have a library. And I said, well, you know, your steward seems to think you've got a library. And he said, anyway, we're very busy. And this was Woking in August. And the one thing that Woking isn't busy is in August.
Anyway, he wasn't motivated to help.
No. So he said, call me back in the autumn. And when I called back, he was very much more friendly. And it turns out that a Lloyd's friend of mine, who was a member of Woking, had sort of primed him and said, well, when this chap Truett phones up again, do at least, you know, give him the time of day. So I was asked to go over there. So I went over on a Saturday. And this was, if you remember, in my sort of golf book dealing days. And late 70s, it must have been. Yes, late 70s. So that's got to be 40 years ago, isn't it? Anyway, and I went over on Mr. Riley, and there in the office, and he said, well, they're the books. And up on the top of his filing cabinets, there were some bound leather ledgers, you know, the caddy register and the minute books and all those sort of. And I said, no, this is, I think we're talking about published volumes. He said, well, we don't have anything like that here. And I said, well, the steward says you do have a library. So this very grumpy steward was summoned on a Saturday morning, and he took us into the kitchen. And he showed me the upright fridge freezer. So he said, well, if you climb onto the top of that, you can see there's a hatch. And just push that up and pull yourself. And I've got up into this attic, which was only, you know, 4 or 5 foot. Couldn't possibly stand up. And there on the gable end, and one of them gave me a torch. And here were these bookshelves, all very much bowing with the weight. And I shone my torch on books that I'd never, ever seen before.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. These were just seriously, seriously early, interesting books. And I was absolutely amazed. So
the club had no idea they had them apart from the steward.
Steward, you see. And he knew about what was above the kitchen, I suppose.
Wow.
Extraordinary.
Stewards know where the bodies are buried.
I mean, fast forwarding, there is no doubt that John Lowe lived very close to Woking. He died quite young. He died in 1929. And he'd been born in 1869.
Mm. Oh, so yeah.
So he definitely left them to the club. And I would surmise that come the war, I bet that clubhouse was requisitioned, and they decided the best place was to put them up in the attic. And, you know, time moves on, people move on, and they'd just been completely forgotten about. So I went up there. They sent me a chair, and I did a list of all the books that were up there. And then I wrote a letter, and I'm rather proud of this letter, and I'm perfectly happy for anybody to see it. And it is all to do with what a club should do if it's got a library of books. And in their case, they had to get them out of the attic. Mm. I mean, the extremes of temperature in an attic like that.
It was amazing.
It's amazing to think that the books weren't in, you know, such a bad state. Quite extraordinary. Yeah. So get them out of the attic, and you've got some of them need a certain amount of repair, and you've got to catalogue them, you've got to insure them, you've got to build bookcases with adjustable shelving and lockable doors. All these provisions were necessary, and the appointment of a club librarian. And I even remember suggesting, and if you can get a younger member to do it, so much the better, because then he can, you know, he can look after these books over a long period of time. Anyway, and I did conclude that, you know, if they felt unable to make all these arrangements, I would be happy to offer them a price for the collection. And after a little while, they came back saying, yes, fully understand, thank you for all your advice, but we would be interested to know what you would give us. So I gave them a price, and it went all very quiet. And then the grapevine started to work, and I heard that they were sort of, dare I say it, sort of touting this collection of books around, particularly. And this was in the very early days. This is how I can remember the date. The early golf auctions, collectible auctions. And in those days, all the big auction houses had collectible department, collectors departments. Yeah. So it wasn't just golf collecting, but it was sports memorabilia and it was, all sorts of stuff was that were big, you know, going back to my conversation. Stuff suddenly became collectible and the auction houses were, you know, jumping onto the bandwagon. And you can imagine committee members at Woking would have known a director of Sotheby's or Christie's or Phillips or Bonhams. And when I heard about this, my next letter to the Woking committee was the follies of selling at auction. This is a letter that was, I'm sure, wasn't as convincing as my previous letter. But, you know, the reality is, I suppose when selling at an auction, it is the sort of unknown, or do you go for the unknown, or do you take somebody's offer and save a lot of commission and that sort of thing? But I think the concluding paragraph of that letter did remind them about, or ask them about, where I would stand if they did sell them at auction. Because, I mean, they'd only discovered them as a result of my efforts.
Yeah.
Anyway, that must have sort of struck a bit of a chord, because I was told that, they would accept my offer and
that's nice.
I would come and collect. But I did go and collect them on a Saturday morning, and I had my list, but I never shared that list. I mean, it was all in my handwriting. So they never had a list. But at that first meeting with Tony Riley, and goodness knows why I had to tell him this, but I did tell him. I said, you know, I could be standing here with all the most valuable books in the pocket of my barber jacket, because these are little mid-19th century pamphlets.
Yeah.
Amazingly, the first hardback book was Clark's Royal and Ancient Game, wonderful book. First hardback golf book, 1875.
Wow.
You know, it seems extraordinary that, because these, and of course these little sort of pamphlet type books, you know, they were chucked out.
Because you think what's the object smaller, of, it's not.
Whereas that wonderful golf book of East Lothian that I was talking about earlier, there's no way you'd ever chuck that
it
out
looks
because
grand.
It's just a magnificent
aesthetic
item. Yeah. Anyway, so you know, I don't know. I told him that. Silly thing to say, really, looking back on it. So when I came to collect them, he said, oh, by the way, I took your advice about all those little books. So he said, I rescued them and I put them in the safe. So go up and collect all the books and then I'll give you the little books. So I went up, checked them all off, and here are all the little ones missing. So I go in, he slides this little stack of books across. I check them off, two missing. There was a few rambling remarks, Chambers, a few rambling remarks on the game of golf, and Rob's historical gossip of golf and golfers.
What brilliant titles.
Both in the 1860s, and both little pamphlets. I'll show them to you later. And I think I'd valued them each at £100. I mean, that might sound derisory now, but that's...
be thousands in today's for a very small pamphlet.
Yeah, and I said, well, I can't, you know, these, you know, this is what I put against those two. I've got to give you £200 less. And I think we were talking about a couple of thousand for the whole lot.
Wow.
Might be 2.5. And... So I said, no, you should really call the police, because it's like having £200 taken out of your till.
Yeah. Mm.
And anyway, on the Sunday, that was on the Saturday, they'd had a special committee meeting, and they decided, quotes, to do nothing more about it because it's all too close to home.
Oh, right. So they never showed up. Wow.
And so a few rambling remarks didn't bother me too much, because there were two copies of that. But the other one, Gossip of Golf and Golfers, remained a major gap in my collection for many years. And just to give you an idea of how things moved on, I think Patino, you know, of Valderrama,
yeah, Valderrama
fame, and he was a great collector. And
was he?
Oh yeah. And there's no doubt he pushed the prices up. Because, you know, when you've got somebody in the market who is so high profile with a bottomless pocket, prices move on up. And he had a guy that always used to, there was a West End antiques dealer who used to buy for him. We never used to see Patino at the auctions, but we knew if this chap was there, he would just bid stuff up until he got it.
I would
this book, The Gossip of Golf and Golfers, was this big gap in the collection. And I had a good friend who had a nice collection of books, and he John Weigel, lovely fellow, and he knew that he was dying. And he was clearly very keen for me to buy his best stuff. So I used to go and see him, and he used to quote a price, and I used to pay it. There was no haggling or anything. And I'm only telling you that because years later, one book that clearly sort of got missed was his copy of Gossip of Golf and Golfers. And I mean, Patino, I think, had paid something close to 20,000 quid for a copy.
Wow. Why is that one so
well
valuable?
Because it's just rare, early. It's early. Any pure golf book published in the 1860s, because
there's only so many copies. Yeah.
And anyway, so Jenny Weigel found it was this little book. You see, it must have got left by. So I was really on my honour about, because, you know, I wanted her to have a decent, because we kept in touch with his widow, and she was very friendly towards our two girls. John married very late in life, and they had about five very happy years together. And during that time, I think, you know, that stage, he knew that he hadn't got many years, and I think they had that 5 years, which only thanks to Jenny coming along and them being very happy together. So we kept in touch with Jenny, and I had to give her a decent price whilst also getting a decent price for myself. So I think I paid her 4,000 quid for it. It was something like that. And the very interesting thing is that he used to collect, John used to keep the sort of correspondence about how he came to buy the book. And there's a letter in the book, and it says, here's the golf book, and so on and so forth. And John paid £60 post free. So, in other words, post included, he paid £60 at pretty much the same time as I was buying. And it wasn't the John Lowe copy, by the way.
Wow.
Because John Lowe in pencil had. So I was really pleased that when I was offering Woking Golf Club £100, he was actually able to buy it full retail at £60.
Yeah.
So that always made me feel better. But I didn't feel better. I mean, basically, the figures don't matter terribly, but I paid more for that one single book than I paid for the whole collection some years earlier.
John Lowe as a figure, so his library there would have been, even in his day, presumably would have been a very revered golfing library. You know, the he was a deep thinker of the game, and because he didn't really design many courses, I mean, you know, for those listening to this podcast, the John Lowe is famous for the fourth hole at Woking with his friend Stuart Patton, and you know, I suppose you look at it now as this moment where we moved into strategic golf design the incorporation of a centerline bunker. But John Lowe was around all these figures and was a deep thinker in the game and was a hugely influential guy, but possibly less well known because there's no sort of golf courses as such where he's you know, beyond Woking.
No, he was the sort of power behind the throne, I think.
Yeah.
You know, he edited Nisbet's Golf Year book for a number of years, so that gave him an annual outlet for any comment. And, you know, he took that Oxford and Cambridge tour to America, you know, the first golfing tour to leave these shores was that 1903, something like that. And if you look at the people who were on that tour.
It's in the photos in Matter of Course, isn't it? And it's It's a who's who of golf in those days, isn't it? I think that photo might be in there.
Yes. Seem to have forgotten that. He was a very influential chap. Didn't have golf courses to his name, but influenced a lot of people who were doing a lot of work.
Mm.
And I'm sure he and Fowler must have been good friends.
Just for our listeners that are not so familiar, just briefly explain the impact that he had going out with Stuart Patton to the fourth hole and digging the centreline bunker at Woking. Just briefly describe the impact that had on the whole of golf course architecture afterwards.
We know it had a direct impact on Fowler's partner Simpson, because Simpson, who was a barrister, he came and sort of looked at what had happened at Woking, and this sort of inspired him. Mm. I mean, that's certainly in the book, and that's common knowledge. But it seems such a sort of blooming obvious thing to us all now. But, you know, the fact is, the penalties were put on, the hazards were put on one side.
Mm.
And, well, no, that's not true, because there was a time when, when the professionals were laying out the courses, that was a bit like a steeplechase, wasn't it? You know, you have par five or a bogey cross five, numbers. You had two cross bunkers to get over and bogey four, just the one. But it's very much different just putting a single hazard in the middle of the fairway, where, you know, you've got the option of going down either side. So it's fundamentally different to the steeplechase. And the members of Woking, when they came back from their holidays at the end of August, they were horrified to think that this perfectly good golf hole had got a blooming crater in the middle of it all.
Rogue action, Stuart Patton, wasn't it? It was
just
took it upon himself. Some of these guys must have been great characters. Am I right in thinking Fowler, just bringing it back to Walton Heath, would have been the stronger player out of all of that set of course designers? And he was a better player than Colt,
Oh, I'm sure.
Simpson,
I was,
and that comes through in the sort of lay of the land and what he built there. It's a demanding test, tee to green. Do you think that's? You talk a lot about where Simpson and perhaps Colt put things on one side and gave you a miss. Fowler seemed to ask a lot more for a straight tee shot and the penalty on both sides. He was perhaps, certainly at Walton Heath, been one of the early courses and, you know, kind of maybe a little bit more penal. Is that fair to say? Or
He was certainly famous for his deep bunkers.
Mm.
But he was also very definite about the player having the opportunity of getting out in one shot. And that's why he'd be horrified at this revetted bunker and getting the ball almost at the right angle, as we've seen in the Open this year. And I've got onto my favourite topic, so you better
What is it?
Well, it's the revetted bunker and the way they're ruined our wonderful British traditional links courses, which are not meant to be manicured. They're meant to be wild and woolly and desolate sort of places. And I think I always refer to the Augusta syndrome, whereby the TV companies feel that you've got to have golf courses all looking beautiful, and it's just not correct. Now, this is George Hamer.
Hi, George.
This is a current legend at Walton Heath. Cheers, George.
We've just been interrupted with a gift arriving.
It's interesting. I was down at Royal St. George's recently, and there was a couple of books out, and there was a members list, and I thumbed my way through, and your eye gets drawn. So I was just looking at handicaps, really, and I was just skimming down this list, and I saw amongst the melee of medium handicaps, there was a plus two. I thought, oh, that's interesting. Just looked across. I think it was about 1903. Plus two, W.H. Fowler.
Yeah.
Mm. Plus two, and I thought, you know, it's interesting because Laidlaw Purvis, who obviously laid out St. George's, would have been a highly penal golf course in terms of his thoughts about architecture were that you should punish bad players and reward good players. And it's certainly not the route that, even though Fowler was a member down at Royal St George's, wasn't a route that he took when he designed Walton Heath.
He had a good library, didn't he, Laidlaw Purvis? Is that right? Did he have a really good library of books or something?
I wasn't aware of that. But
so you can tell your story.
I really just want to go in the podcast. But I think I read somewhere that Laidlaw Purvis had a really big library of texts. And then I think he sold those to C.B. McDonald. And that's now the library that sits in National Golf Links of America.
That rings a bell. That does ring a bell.
You didn't write it, did you, Mr. Truett?
What?
You didn't write that, did you? And he's read it in one of your books somewhere.
No, passing it off as my knowledge.
No. I think I remember seeing that somewhere.
Yeah.
Something about Delft tiles in there.
Well, I'm obsessed with this thing about, you know, the Dutch Delft tiles, the golf figurines, which is the same as the Prince's logo, but it's also used for the National Golf Links of America logo.
Yes,
I think those Dutch tiles, the Delft tiles, were included in his set. We digress. Can we come back to the bunkers? Because I think that this is particularly interesting.
Yes, the ability to a flat bottom bunker where the ball should roll to give the player a chance. Mm. And you see, this is what's not happening. I think one of the very good things I have seen around, because if you have lots of lovely, new, fresh, fluffy sand, and just forgetting about, not talking about the revetted bunker now, and as the ball comes down the face, whatever that face is made of, it doesn't carry on rolling because it just drops into this fluffy. So there are some clubs now who are only raking the bottoms of the bunkers.
That's right, yeah.
So the sloping part of the bunker it's very quickly flattened, isn't it, by the rain. And that gives you a much better chance. I think that's, and it must save a lot of time.
I suppose the argument for the Open this year, Royal Liverpool, was that professional golfers now are not finding bunkers the hazards that they perhaps once were.
Absolutely.
And that's why they're trying to kind of make it more difficult. And of course, they wouldn't have raked them back in back in the day. No. I mean, where do you stand on raking?
Well, yes. You know, who was the man that sent a greenkeeper out with a rake to, quotes, rake the bunkers? Somebody must have done it. Been the first.
Because it never used to happen.
And you get the reports in the papers saying, fortunately, Braid was not in a heel mark. You know, so that's almost expected to happen.
What would you stand on, you know, talking about the history of the game and Hickory Golf and all? Would you be a fan of bringing back unraked sand hazards?
I did actually write a chapter in when Grant Books republished Bowers Hazards. Bob Grant got one or two of us to contribute, and because Bob, even in those days, knew that I had these firm views, he got me to write a chapter. And in fact, it was Bob who gave it a chapter about to rake or not to rake bunkers. I think in that article that I wrote that I felt that if I sort of suggested that we shouldn't rake bunkers any longer, I would lose too many friends. So I decided not to be quite as
forceful. Toe the party line.
Yeah. I remember rakes in bunkers. I mean, they've got to be very carefully, you know, because for years we just used to rake over with the back of our club, you know, our heel marks. But now with the rake, yes. And when I was writing that article or planning to write it on the playing in a competition at Walton, third of the new, there's a bunker that runs down the left-hand side, quite unusually for Walton. And I found a brand new ball underneath the tee of the rake.
Really?
So this ball had been lost in a competition by somebody actually sitting underneath that part of the rake, which completely covered it. So that's about as
progress
unfair.
Progress is a dangerous thing, isn't it? And
just well, progress is another.
Well, I want to talk about, I suppose, you know, things like the event last week, and I said, like, some progress is not always good, and then some progress is
really good. Yeah,
I mean, and I think, you know, last night I think you sent me an email just checking I wasn't going to stand you up this morning, but your signature on your email says, "What you know, it's something
brilliant.
Like,
it is
tradition is not the worship of ashes, but the preservation of fire."
Yeah,
and
can you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, those of us who are very keen on the tradition and the heritage and everything else, it's preserving something very special. And I think it's that's a worthy thing to be doing.
It's interesting because I read the bottom of your email, and I find it resonated quite nicely with the ethos of Walton Heath as a golf club, because although it's got incredible history, it's not afraid to be progressive in certain areas move with the times.
Yeah, I'd like to think, yes, you can't just dwell on stuff that's just because it's happened historically. It doesn't mean to say, I think it's a sort of slowly evolving world, isn't it? I mean, you can't possibly just expect everything to be this. Well, it isn't the same, and it would be daft to think that you could keep it. But I think the most important thing is for us to keep the fundamentals. And I think by and large, I mean, I give a huge amount of credit to the triumvirate, Varden, Braden, Taylor, to the way in which they conducted themselves. And okay, I know we're 100 years away from them, but the way in which professional golfers conduct themselves is actually pretty darn good still. You know, of all the sportsmen, okay, I suppose it could be argued that, you know, you just can't afford to behave badly and lose your temper playing golf, because that just makes your golf even worse. I don't know. But the way in which we conduct ourselves, I think, can be taken back to those days, because they set such a good standard.
I don't suppose you've ever heard this. I've heard it mentioned. Have you ever heard of the great, great quadrivium? Sandy Heard would join the triumvirate for a short period of time, apparently.
So often they had these. They made their money not by winning prize money, but having these exhibition matches. Mm. And of course, they always needed a fourth, and very often the fourth would be the local pro.
Yeah.
But Heard was a favourite to make up the four, because I mean, in that 20-year period, there were only, try and get this right, we know that 16 years were taken up by Varden six and Taylor and Braid's five championships each, so that's 16. And you had Sandy Heard winning with a Haskell rubber cord ball in Royal Liverpool in 02, is that right?
I don't know the year, but
yeah.
You're testing us on knowing his name.
That's got to be right on the limit here.
And then Arnaud Massey, the Frenchman, so he wouldn't have been around very much. Ted Ray.
Of course, yeah.
Yes, he would have been about, and who was the other one? George Duncan. Did he win before?
Deal, wasn't it 21? Was it?
Yeah, George Duncan did win it.
No. I'm talking about the 20 years leading up to the Great War. I'm sure I've missed somebody out.
We won't hold it against
you. I'm sure there were four of them. So. You can understand why Heard was...
Because they'd be putting it in the newspapers, try and drum up attention, and so people would come and pay and watch and play.
But I think just lingering on it, and that event last week, you know, the atmosphere in the clubhouse was brilliant, wasn't it? I think the twists and the things that went into it are not things that you would typically... So, you know, if you'd have said 40, 50 years ago that you're going to have Ellie Goulding playing a concert on a Saturday night at your home club, where you're hosting, you know, the Women's British Open, you're going to have the fan zone alive with all sorts of fun. You're going to see all these kids and stuff. I'm not saying you wouldn't believe them, but it's a modern spin on doing something that's progressive and different, in the same way that maybe George Riddell would have laid out, you know, tournaments and thought innovatively about how to develop the interests of its club. And that's why I brought up the quote in the email signature, because I read it as, actually you just take the ethos of what you've got from the history and you apply it to the modern day rather than just it being a case of always being reverential to the past, I guess.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Yes, I mean, that it's sort of, if you like, my strap line. I think my younger daughter presented it to me. It's not the golf clubs. It's amazing. Because I went to the Pop concert.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it. Marvellous, marvellous occasion. And I said to somebody, well, I haven't missed out on much that's happened here over the last 60 years, and I certainly wasn't going to miss out on that.
Can't miss that.
It was great. It was a great occasion. And what I've learned is that with those two enormous screens either side of the... Were you there?
Yes.
Yeah, you were. Those two screens, you don't have to be right up close. So we were, I'm sure, quite well back. Well, very well back. And, of course, you can also position yourself further away from the loudspeakers if it suits you.
Must have been great, though.
Do we know how many people were there?
No. I mean, hazard a guess at 10,000, maybe, something like that. But
no, it was perfectly comfortable.
But it must have been lovely seeing so many kids coming in and enjoying it. And seeing Walton Heath is a really progressive and cool place to be as well, actually. Yeah. And I think the same, we were chatting to Sharon, the front of house manager, on this morning, just on the lead up to this. And, you know, even the way I think, you know, I'm sure people have different opinions on things all the time, but I think it's really hard for golf clubhouses. I love golf clubhouses, particularly old ones. And it's really hard to sort of refurb them and give them a new lease of life without making them all look like a sort of a new chintzy country club. And it does a really good job at Walton Heath with the way the heritage is displayed and the muted colour tones and stuff.
I think, those dark walls, I mean, we've only ever had sort of white, cream walls. And I think the way in which our portraits are displayed with their gilt frames, and we are, perhaps you've heard, we are sort of working on all of that to make them even, the Holderness portrait has been completely reframed. That is a completely new frame.
One above the medals, isn't it? Where you've got all the President Putter.
Yeah, and that looks fabulous. There's a very old, established third generation framers in London, founded in 1902, and they made that frame at a considerable cost, but it does look, I think it looks absolutely fabulous.
How does it feel to just sort of taking aside, that we're taking a reflection on last week? How does it feel to have the Women's British Open here at Walton Heath? How was the week for you as a member?
We've gone off piste a number of times, haven't we? It's always difficult to get back on the piste. I was saying, you know, our forefathers embraced top-class amateur and professional golf from the word go. And, you know, that is what we continue to do. And I think it's wonderful. And we can present it in the way that is felt to be best at the time. And that's why, having the facilities, having the land is enormously helpful, because if you think of the area that was taken up by not only the practice ground, but that sufficient space to have the Pop concert. Now, whether they're going to do that at St. Andrews next year, I mean, you are confronted with the logistical possibility, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, they've kind of made a rod for their own back now, because if there's something they've done successfully here has become a success, and they now need to find infrastructure to build a concert somewhere else, or however they choose to approach it.
In answer to your question, I feel immensely proud. I've felt very privileged and humbled being elected a member here 60 years ago, and nothing has changed. I feel equally privileged and humbled to this day.
I mean, I'm conscious we were given another you're a very, very busy man, and you've got an appointment in 30 minutes.
No, in fact, I haven't got that appointment.
Oh, well, we're here, we're locked in. Speaking of top class...
Shut the door, sorry.
Top class... Shut the door. Speaking of top class female performances, something we touched on very briefly earlier on was the Cecil Leach match here. I wonder whether you could...
That was pure innovation, but that had never, ever happened before.
No.
You know, a man v woman match.
And I suppose it was at the time of the suffragettes and all of that. So there were huge undertones. And for Riddell to allow the course to be overrun by, was it 5,000 people, something like that?
Wow, was it?
And it caused a huge amount of interest. And I suppose rubbed off nicely on the club. And
so it was a 72-hole match?
Yeah.
She chased him down, didn't she? 36 holes here, and I think she was one down.
One down, I think.
And then there was a rest day, and then they went to Sunningdale, and I think she forged ahead at Sunningdale, didn't she, and beat Hilton.
Yes. Amazing.
It was quite interesting because we did. We were chatting to Jill Thornhill, who is an incredible force of nature, I will add.
Yeah.
About her winning the Ladies Amateur Championship in 1983, and she was talking about Cecil Leach. And our first ever golf club film, we do these story of a golf club films, was about Silithon Solway, which is where she played her golf.
Yeah.
And that's where Jill won in 1983, yeah. Which I didn't know, yeah. Which was quite neat, I thought.
Yeah.
But there's a pretty good history at the club, isn't there, with good women's good golf in the women's game, you know, not just Jill, but was it Nicola Taylor was telling me Diane Bailey? I'm going to get this wrong. Yeah. She was the first ever captain.
Yeah, Diane Bailey was Curtis Cup, but she never, I think I'm right in saying this, she never sort of played out of Walton.
Mm.
I think her club was Reigate Heath.
Okay.
But she's been a member here for many years, and she is a great supporter, and both of them, Jill and Diane, never seem to mind who they're playing with.
Mm.
And our younger daughter, Victoria, who took up the game age 30, about 10 years or so ago, still playing off, you know, quite a long handicap, but really playing very well. Those two are perfectly happy to play with her, not because she's Victoria Tewitt, she's just a member of the club.
Mm.
And they don't hold any favours. You know, they're both marvellous ambassadors to the extent they don't mind who they play with.
How do you feel about sort of the legacy of the, obviously we just had the women's Open here, the legacy of that tournament in terms of moving forward? What was the most successful part of it for Walton Heath, do you feel, in terms of be it the course or the way that the competition was laid out, or why do you think it was so successful?
I would have thought that it was our ability to cope really very well and very successfully with such a big event.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think they had, was it 800 volunteers?
Yeah.
800. Yeah.
And you know, that was marshalled by one of our lady members, and that willingness throughout the club to contribute, I think
it was,
because you know the golf courses are great, and but you know they've been there a long time, and I would have thought it was if somebody was thinking about, gosh, well, should we have a tournament at Walton Heath or should we go somewhere else, I would have thought it's the members' attitude towards being happy to be part of that successful, that is of paramount importance, I would have thought.
We saw you out there most days. Were you pleased with how well the course held up, considering we've had a very wet summer?
Yeah.
That was preceded by a really dry spring.
Yeah.
But the course, I thought, played... We started off quite wet because we'd had that deluge on the Tuesday.
Yeah, I suppose us purists... would love to have seen all the fairways nice and brown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in many ways our ultimate defence, because unless you hit it absolutely straight down the middle, that so many of the fairways are slightly domed. I mean, Darwin wrote about this, and actually he would say that seeing a seemingly a wide open fairway in front of you doesn't half encourage you to just hit it that much further or that much harder, but actually unless you get it absolutely straight, all that's going to happen is that the ball will just run and run and run and run off the fairways. Mm. And if they're brown, there's much more chance of that happening. And of course, for years, we never had semi-rough. You know, it was just straight into the heather. But the semi-rough is not such a big deal because it's, by and large, it's only usually a very narrow strip.
Mm.
And okay, so... you know, this is the first year where we've had fairway watering, and one is absolutely assured that it's only ever going to be used, particularly in the growing season, because we know that with those natural heathland grasses, people might think that we've, quotes, lost the fairways, but we haven't lost the fairways. I mean, last summer was a classic example, and that was pre-fairway watering. They were mahogany brown.
Mm.
And a couple of showers of rain in early September, and it almost changes overnight. Okay, so it was a shame. And it actually also, colour-wise, it looks rather good. I mean, a golf course doesn't always just have to be bright green, does it? Having the contrast. And I think it was wonderful how the heather was out, because that gave a contrast, didn't it?
For a TV coverage, it looked absolutely spectacular.
Yeah.
And you might want a little browner for, like you say, for the purists, but I think it was a wonderful advert for a great place.
Yeah. And the quid pro quo is that, yes, the ball wasn't running as far, but it meant that the holes were playing longer.
Mm.
I think I did hear that, apparently, some of the players were...
Yeah, there's a lot, not complaints, but we were in the media centre prior to the tournament, and a lot of the players were coming in saying it's long. We're having to hit a lot of fairway woods into greens, and the way that this course is. So the fourth of the old, so the second on the championship course with the centerline bunker.
Yeah.
Thank you, John Lone, Stuart Patton. That was causing them some real problems because they were all hitting. I mean, Nelly Cordes said she was hitting like three wood, because they just couldn't. They didn't take on that.
And
bunker.
She's a huge hitter.
Yeah. So it's.
No, it was a brilliant tournament, and I think it dried out through the week, and therefore, you know, a bit more run, and that brought a different dimension into it as well, because then it was harder to control the woods and hybrids that were coming into the greens.
Do you think they would have had better scores if they bumped and runned it more?
I don't know. I suppose it would just be interesting. I couldn't tell you. In the early couple of rounds, they were stopping three woods and five woods with incredible precision because it was a little softer. But you could see the course had dried out through the weekend, where actually getting pin high was all of a sudden a much tougher task because the ball's not stopping. So, but I thought it was. I think the way the weather set up and the way the course set up meant that the event provided a very broad range of it asked a different question, moving in a different direction throughout the week. So, in terms of just thinking about bringing this podcast to a close, I suppose there's a couple of things I'd like to just pick your brains on. One question we've asked a few of our previous guests, particularly those that are interested in the history of the game, is the question that if I was to give you a time travel machine and I could send you back to one specific moment in time and a certain event or a certain passage of events and get you back safely, where would you go to? What course, what turn of events in the game would you go back to if I gave you one ticket to be a fly on the wall?
Straight off, nobody's ever asked me that question before, so it's very interesting. I suppose off the top of my head, I can't help feeling when Bernard Darwin left the bar to become a sort of full-time professional golf correspondent. I mean, can you imagine the shock that must have rippled through this very distinguished Darwin family? But anyway, the first... I would love to have gone with him to his first ever Open Championship, Prestwick, 1908.
Nice.
And to see Braid in that first round knock it round, not that they would have referred to knocking it round in those days, knocking it round in 72, sort of unheard of score. And I think that had quite a profound impact on... Darwin, and it would certainly, you know, if I'd been a young member, a contemporary of Darwin's, as a member here, to see one's own pro to go round. And then, of course, he went on and he scored a total of 281 shots at 281, and that was a he reduced the score. No, it can't be 281. 291. Sorry about that. Right. 291. And that reduced the score by 5 shots.
Right.
So I've got a putter, an aluminium D-shaped mm-hmm. Mills putter made by, you know, the man who was a great industrialist who okay. worked a lot in aluminium. So he had in fact, he made a complete range of clubs with aluminium heads. But the putters were really the only ones that took off. And I've got the putter that says copy putter used by Jay Braid, Open Championship, Prestwick 1908, record score 291. So that's on the back of the putter. So taking your...
That's a great answer.
That's taking your question. I would have celebrated... So I've been up to Darwin, travelled up with Darwin, which would have been a pretty interesting experience alone, then watching cocktails. That round of golf, seeing him win with a record score, and then buying one of these copy putters that was just... We have no idea. I mean, I've looked at all the magazines at the time because I thought they might have been advertised, but they weren't advertised, and I have a feeling... I mean, I've heard of one other putter that says, with this legend on the back... So I would, if I'd been able to get one at the time, I would have been pretty quick off the mark, I would think.
Wow.
Wow. Brilliant answer. Yeah. It's interesting that some people come out with some wonderfully specific answers, and that is absolutely no exception. My other curiosity would be, we've got a lot of people listening to this who will have an interesting golf history and clubs that are involved in trying to better preserve their heritage. And it could almost feel quite overfacing for anybody who's not in your position with everything that you've managed to work hard to acquire and catalogue throughout your time. Any words of wisdom to any people with the faintest interest in golf history?
Well, I have a passionate belief that a club's heritage and its history is one of its biggest assets. And that is not, by and large, that's not generally known. People think of the usual assets, you know, the buildings and the equipment and the land and the golf courses and everything. But the history is hugely important. And this isn't just me dwelling on the old days. This is actually recognizing that history. And, you know, however a humble a golf club it is, it will have its own history. You know, just an ordinary local golf club that's never hosted a major tournament, nothing like that, has been a place where, for however many years, 100 years, 50 years, is a place where people have enjoyed themselves. And I think to be able to convey that to the aspiring member of that club, that this is a special place. And if pictures have been hung on the wall that recognise that that involvement and items of interest, it'll all help to show somebody that this is a special place.
Well, Mr. Philip Truitt, you've been an absolute delight to have on the podcast. It's been 2 years in the making, and it's been such an honour to be able to come to your library, to your home, to be able to talk to you. So thank you so much taking time out of your day to speak to us, and I'm chuffed a bit, I must say.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, and it's very hard for me to imagine anybody being the slightest bit interested. But that's for you guys to decide. Thank you. Watch this.